In an age of mass deportation, one Latin American country has a different approach. Give migrants a legal permission to work and send their kids to local schools.
They'll take care of themselves, you know, and I think that kind of pragmatism is getting lost in some of the ideological debates around immigration.
A fresh take on migration and asylum today. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Also in the show, a new law in Italy means harsher punishments for those who commit violence against women. And what's changing on the menu this Thanksgiving?
It's not just a traditional Thanksgiving, but it comes with food from all over the world.
It's been more than 20 years in the making. The Grand Egyptian Museum is finally open for visitors.
Just the architecture of the building alone, never mind all the artifacts in there, it's just so impressive.
We've got all those stories and more ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Marco Werman is out for the day. Glad you are with us as we head into a long holiday weekend. Since early September, the U.S. military has carried out more than 20 military strikes in the Caribbean and Eastern Pacific, killing more than 80 people in international waters. The Pentagon has publicly released short video clips of the strikes. Trump administration officials say the attacks are targeting drug smuggling boats. Locals who work in the fishing industry fear that the U.S. military campaign is not just targeting drug smugglers. They say it's putting their livelihood and their lives at risk as well. Manuel Rueda reports from the Caribbean coast of Colombia.
I'm in a small fishing boat about a mile off the coast of Santa Marta in Colombia. It's about 18 feet long and 3 feet wide. Now, the fish you can get here are pretty small ones. They weigh about 7 ounces and pretty much fit in your hand. The fisherman I'm with, Manuel Yepes, manages to pull out about a dozen of these little fish using a long nylon line. He celebrates his first catch of the day.
Ahí viene, gente. Vamos activo.
But while Yepes is grateful for the catch, he says these are tough times. In this time of year, he would usually be fishing deep in the sea, looking for more profitable species like tuna.
No podemos pescar mar abierto por los bombardeos.
U.S. bombings are keeping us from fishing in the open seas, he explains. We're afraid of what could happen to us if we go out there. In the past 2 months, the Trump administration has shot down more than 20 small boats in the Caribbean and the Eastern Pacific, as it wages a controversial campaign against drug traffickers and puts military pressure on Venezuela's government. Some of the boats that have been hit have a similar shape and size to those used by traditional fishermen in Santa Marta and other parts of the Southern Caribbean. And that has made people here fearful that they could be targeted by mistake. Leonardo Vega is the president of the Santa Marta Fishing Captains Association.
Hay una persona de nosotros que ha sido bombardeada y
we already have a colleague who has been bombed, he says. Vega says that on September 15, the U.S. hit Santa Marta fisherman Alejandro Carranza. It's a claim denied by the Trump administration, which says it has only been going after proven drug traffickers. But Vega says that his friend has been missing since September, when he told his family he was going on a long trip with another fisherman. Vega believes there are several signs they were killed. While he talks on the beach, he shows me footage of the strike, where you can see a boat with two engines floating on the sea, and two people whose faces cannot be recognized in the back of the boat. In a few seconds, everything turns into a ball of fire.
Si tú te das cuenta, es una embarcación tipo Eduardoño.
The boat's bow is somewhat rounded, just like the boats we use, Vega says. He says the boat in the video has two engines, which is what fishermen here usually use on long trips.
Los narcotraficantes y las personas que se dedican al
drug traffickers will use 3 or 4 engines because they need to move their product fast, he says. Bodies from the explosion have not been found. But regardless of who was on the boat, the incident has made the local fishermen cautious, and most are now working within sight of the shore. Vega says that fishermen here will need subsidies from the Colombian government to make up for the income they're losing.
Obviamente impacta nuestro bolsillo, nuestra economía.
Our pockets have been hit hard, he says. We have families that are only eating 2 meals a day. In Providencia, a Colombian island in the Western Caribbean, fishermen say they're also afraid of U.S. strikes because there are drug trafficking routes close to their fishing spots. Edgar J. directs the local Fishers Association. He says all their boats have only two engines, but they're shaped like the ones that have been hit.
El 99% de la flota pesquera de Providencia son lanchas.
99% of our fleet is made up of small boats, he says, so there's a chance we could be confused for drug traffickers. Jay says that boats in the island are going out in groups now for more safety, and argues the Trump administration is breaking the law with its airstrikes.
He can take the papers and present to the judge, but he are not known judge, and he are not known God to decide on people's life.
It's a tough time for these fishermen, who say they've been caught in a fight between the U.S. and its enemies. For The World, I'm Manuel Rueda, Santa Marta, Colombia.
Later this hour, we'll have more from Colombia when we look at global changes in how countries receive migrants and people claiming asylum. That is still ahead. $40 billion. That is how much Taiwan's president is asking lawmakers to approve for a new military spending package. President Lai Ching-te says the money is needed because of China's recent moves. Beijing has been building up its military, which threatens Taiwan and others in the region. The president's request comes as Taiwan is trying to increase its defense spending. William Young is an analyst with the International Crisis Group based in the Taiwanese capital, Taipei.
By next year, Taiwan is hoping to enhance defense budget to 3.5% and by 2030 to 5% of the GDP. However, there is also serious pushback from the opposition party because they don't think that Taiwan can afford such a, you know, high percentage of its GDP going to defense.
The $40 billion would go toward Taiwan's air defense system, AI integration in the military, and new domestic weapons manufacturing in Taiwan. President Trump has been calling on Taiwan to boost its military spending, which involves buying weapons systems from the U.S. Taiwan's opposition party also has qualms there.
Another strain of the argument is they cannot see Taiwan become a so-called ATM for the United States.
Taiwan's legislature would need to sign off on the new defense funding request. Meanwhile, Taiwan has also found itself at the center of a new diplomatic dispute from China and Japan. The new Japanese prime minister recently said that Japan would get involved on Taiwan's behalf if a military conflict between China and Taiwan erupted. Those comments angered Beijing, which sees Taiwan as a renegade province that should eventually be unified with China. Taiwan is a self-governing democratic island, but its sovereignty is ambiguously recognized by other nations. The Olympic torch is on its way to Italy for the Winter Olympics, a couple months away. The torch was lit today at a ceremony in Olympia, Greece. The flame will now be carried in a relay until the February 6th opening ceremony in Milan. Philip Barker is a longtime sports journalist and editor of the Journal of Olympic History. He was at the archaeological site at ancient Olympia today for the torch lighting, which he said had to be moved inside and adapted.
The weather conditions on the day are absolutely all important. We have a high priestess, and she will approach a large parabolic bowl and apply the torch. It's a bit like lighting a fire with a magnifying glass or something like that.
It's kind of a mirrored surface so that it concentrates the sun rays.
That's right. Yeah, that's exactly right. And of course, the crucial thing is that you have to have a blue sky, clear sky, so that you can see the sun. Otherwise, you will not get the sun's rays coming down and igniting the Olympic flame.
So the flame now, is actually lit by the sun.
Exactly. That's the whole point. When they started up the torch relay back in 1936, there was a wonderful Greek geographer and scholar, and he said, let's not light it with a match. Let's do something more romantic. Why not get a mirror and have the Apollonian light, the light of Apollo, to light the Olympic flame? So this is the idea, that having this ceremony here in ancient Olympia provides us with a connection between the ancient and modern.
So, Philip, you mentioned that the weather is all important. The torch is supposed to be lit by the sun's rays, but the weather did not cooperate this time. So where was the ceremony and how did the torch get lit?
Well, the torch was actually lit on Monday. This is a theatrical performance with music and dance. So the ladies come in. They did conduct their final rehearsal on Monday afternoon, which was a glorious sunny afternoon. The clouds parted, the gods played along, and the torch was lit. And then they brought along their safety lamp. It's like a storm lamp, and they conserve this flame in the lamp so that whatever happens, they have a flame that is lit in the sacred place. Now, the ladies come in, they're dressed in beautiful costumes, their long flowing robes. The high priestess makes an invocation to the gods, to Apollo in particular, and she says, bring us the flame, bring us the Apollonian flame. And when they use a reserve flame, as they did today, she will say, you have brought us the flame. Mm. This is all in Greek. So the verbs are very, very complex and the meaning is very subtly changed. But she says, you have brought us the flame. And of course, this is the flame that they collected the other day. And they've been keeping it under watchful guard day and night so that it could be brought into the ceremony indoors.
Now that the torch is lit, I know that it'll be relayed to the site of the Winter Games in Italy. Can you give me a little bit of an overview of the path it will take this year?
Yes, well, it will spend the first week or so in Greece. And then on December the 4th, they have a special ceremony in Athens. And there they will officially entrust the flame to the organizers of Milano Cortina 2026. 2 days later, in the eternal city of Rome, the domestic relay will begin.
So, Philip, as this torch makes its way to Milan, what happens if a gust of wind blows it out?
Well, the torch is designed, every torch is designed for this not to happen. And they put it into wind tunnels. They do all kinds of scientific tests on it. And of course, yes, it does go out from time to time. But remember that they lit the torch from a lantern, which has conserved the flame. They have a lantern accompanying the relay. Mm. There's a big cavalcade that will travel around Italy with this torch.
So they have a backup flame.
A backup flame so that they can just relight the flame with an Olympic flame.
Mm. Philip, a cynic could say that this is just kind of a bunch of fake pageantry, but you are clearly a fan. Why?
I mean, I'm sitting with one of the Reuters guys who's a bit of a cynic. I know him, but I think what it is that people are looking for symbols in the world. Sport is one of those things that does bring people together. I mean, there was a lot of controversy when the flame was first introduced because it was introduced for the 1936 Olympics in Berlin, which were particularly controversial because Adolf Hitler used them for propaganda. So, I mean, in fact, when they tried to revive it after the war, one of the newspapers called it an antiquarian sham. And the organizers had to say, well, look, this is actually something that we're trying to do to promote peace. And everybody who carries the torch, for each of them, it's such a special moment. I mean, I've been lucky enough to carry the flame twice.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, 2012 in my hometown of London. But I also carried it here in Greece in 1996. So, you know, you do get quite emotional about it. You know, there are problems. It's a gesture and it's a symbolism. Whether that will stop war, of course it won't. But if they start thinking about it, then maybe some people do it, you know. So anything that can actually bring about a more peaceful world is probably quite a good thing.
Philip Barker edits the Journal of Olympic History. He joined us from Greece following today's lighting of the Olympic torch. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Supermarkets are super busy this time of year. And as you're cruising the aisles for yams and cranberry sauce, turn your mind to this story we reported last fall about a different kind of cruising in supermarkets. In Spain, a social media trend had people using produce to signal their interest in getting a date. The World's Jerry Haddon brought us the story from Barcelona about love and chaos in the grocery store.
There's a pineapple shortage across Spain, at least in the supermarket chain Mercadona, because each evening between 7 and 8 p.m., the pineapple placed upside down in your shopping cart sends a signal. You're there to flirt. That's the word anyway online.
Son las 7 de la tarde en Mercadona.
Vinimos a Mercadona a la hora de ligar y adivinen.
So I head to the nearest Mercadona to see what this new single scene is all about.
Walking to Mercadona, Saturday night, 6:58.
Once inside, I work my way to the pineapples, but they've all been snatched up. It doesn't take long to spot one, though. Just like the internet said, it's upside down in a shopping cart, a cart being pushed by three 16-year-olds, Alex Ferre, Andres Peña, and Alex Jimenez. We got the last one, says Ferre, laughing. I ask them why they're here. Because everyone's doing it, he says, it's for laughs. Ferre's pal, Alex Jimenez, is more serious. I'm looking for love, he says. Has it worked, I asked? I don't know yet, he says. This is my first try. The other item in the boys' cart, a cucumber. I wish them luck, and who knows, they might just have some, because a moment later, in the canned goods aisle...
Just passed two young teenage girls with canned pineapples in their shopping cart, giggling away.
Canned pineapples turned upside down, it seems, still get the message out. There are other codes, too, circulating online, on TikTok and Instagram. Like, if you're just interested in a fling, put lettuce in your cart, anything that goes bad quickly. A long-term relationship? Try a bag of dried lentils. They last forever. And if you really want to be direct, just crash your shopping cart into someone else's. This all started, apparently, with this well-known Spanish TV actress, Vivi Lynn. She filmed herself and a friend working the aisles of a Mercadona, laughing and chatting about the 7 to 8 p.m. time frame for getting lucky. Her clip on TikTok has millions of views. As to how Lynn found out about the trend, she hasn't said. This much we know. Mercadona denies it's behind the campaign, and Mercadona is getting a lot of publicity. So much that other chains have followed suit. The French-owned supermarket Carrefour announced on X that it was creating a love corner in its Spanish stores. It posted a photo of some patio furniture with hearts all around it. And the German-owned chain Lidl has just made its move, announcing also on X that its pickup hour is the earliest, from 6 to 7 p.m. Lidl's secret signal produce, the watermelon.
Okay, I'm in Lidl, and I just grabbed half a watermelon, put it on my top shelf of my shopping cart. Let's see what happens.
And exactly nothing happens, which is a relief since I have a partner and kids and go to supermarkets for that other reason, to buy food. Although today...
Sorry, I'm not buying the watermelon.
It's hard to tell if anyone is really on the make in these markets. In the end, this could just end up as another example of an online rumor going viral, leading to silly human behavior, or to chaos. This was a recent evening in a Mercadona store in Spain's north. It's on TikTok. You see a crowd of young people moving around the produce section, laughing, pushing carts stuffed with items speaking a secret, silent language of love. The manager called the police to clear the place. No one was arrested, nor were there reports of anyone actually hooking up. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Barcelona.
Jerry reported that story for us about the supermarkets earlier this fall. Now, in a country known for some of the oldest wonders of the world, a new one has emerged. The Grand Egyptian Museum opened its doors this month, but good luck getting tickets. After more than 20 years of waiting, visitors are flocking to the new building. It has a view of the ancient pyramids of Giza and stands as a modern-day monument to the art of preserving the past. From Cairo, Nadine Tagg reports.
Standing just 2 kilometers from the Great Pyramids of Giza, this monumental structure has been described as the world's largest archaeological museum and the largest ever dedicated to a single civilization. The museum's facade, made of sand-colored concrete and translucent alabaster cut into triangular shapes, rises around a pyramid-shaped entrance that seems to glow from within. The museum unfolds through 12 exhibition halls, each organized by era and theme, from prehistory to the Greco-Roman period, exploring Egyptian society, kingship, and belief. Let's step inside. Immediately before you, towering above the atrium, stands the colossal 3,200-year-old statue of King Ramses II, weighing 83 tons and standing 35 feet high. This ancient pharaoh greets every visitor who crosses the threshold, a reminder of Egypt's timeless grandeur. Beyond him stretches the grand staircase, 6 stories high, lined with more than 60 artifacts. At the top of the stairs, daylight pours through a vast glass window, framing the pyramids of Giza in the distance. The museum was packed with Egyptians and foreigners alike, and we talked to some people about their experience. One of them was Paula from Spain, who told us about her visit.
I think the best part of the museum is the main entrance. Amazing. The scenery is really great because you can see the pyramid while you are visiting the museum. The Tutankhamun Gallery is a unique space in the world. You cannot see a collection like that in other parts of the world. It could be a museum separate from the whole museum, only a museum for that gallery.
Perhaps the museum's greatest treasure awaits in the Tutankhamun Gallery, devoted entirely to the boy king. He took the throne at just 9 years old, ruling more than 3,400 years ago during the 18th dynasty. His tomb was discovered by a British archaeologist in 1922 in the Valley of the Kings, and it captivated the world. Visiting the Tutankhamun Gallery, Muhammad Hassan from Egypt was in awe. I love the Tutankhamun Hall, he says. Having the entire collection displayed together in one place is fascinating. Inside the hall, you'll find his gold mask, shining under soft light, while many Egyptians and foreigners stand in line for a picture. There's a display of jewelry and weapons, and in huge glass containers, war chariots and Tutankhamun's carved throne stand tall. The architecture of the museum is incredible, Hassan says. The design and shapes on the walls are pyramid-like, echoing the geometry of the original pyramids. The museum was first proposed back in 1992 during the rule of President Hosni Mubarak. Construction began in 2005, and now, decades later, the Grand Egyptian Museum stands complete. Karen from New Zealand says it's not just the exhibitions that are incredible.
I just think the way that they've got the staircases going up and just the architecture of the building alone, never mind all the artifacts in there, it's just so impressive.
After years of anticipation, the Grand Egyptian Museum is now up and running, welcoming visitors from all over the world. The halls were packed during opening week, visitors queue for photos with the gold mask, and tour groups gathered beneath the statue of Ramses II. The pyramids outside the window have stood for a millennium. Inside, Egypt's newest landmark begins its own story. For the world, this is Nadine Tag.
We have got lots more stories ahead for you. You are listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Governments across Europe and here in this country have taken on harsher anti-immigrant policies in recent years. But Latin America has taken a different approach. The region's largest migration crisis pushed millions of Venezuelans to flee their home country over the past decade. Neighboring Colombia and Brazil have welcomed them with open arms by creating legal pathways to citizenship for Venezuelans. The World's Tibi Saizea reports on how that approach worked and why it is now at risk.
When Adrianca Arevalo left Venezuela 10 years ago, she was a young professional with a college degree and no place to use it, because her country was collapsing. She left during the hunger crisis, she remembers. Hyperinflation had wiped out salaries, supermarkets were empty, and daily power outages lasted hours. So she crossed the border into Colombia and arrived in Bogotá, the capital, with a suitcase and no clear plan. Venezuelans were pouring in, she says, some on foot, walking for days, selling whatever they could to survive. Soon, Colombia had received millions of people, and the government made a bold choice to welcome them. It created a free temporary protection permit that gave Venezuelans 10 years of legal status. For Arevalo, that permit changed everything.
Eso fue algo muy positivo para los venezolanos porque nos permitía empezar a trabajar en otros lugares.
She says that permit gave her the opportunity to work right away. Within days of arriving in Colombia, she found a job as a teacher. More than 2 million Venezuelans received the same permit, and it became one of the largest regularization efforts in the world and one of the most generous. Ana Karina Garcia, who runs a nonprofit helping migrants in Colombia, says the policy was pragmatic.
Es un permiso que te permite tener acceso a todo lo que necesitas tener para integrarte. La verdad es que es un permiso bastante sólido, se llama el permiso
de protección temporal. With just one ID, Venezuelans could work, rent homes, and enroll their kids in school. Elsewhere in the region, Argentina and Uruguay also offered fast-track residency for Venezuelans. And then there was Brazil, even more generous.
Brazil's probably the example of a country that really allowed almost everyone to stay and become a permanent resident eventually.
Andrew Seeley is with the Migration Policy Institute. He says Brazil launched a massive federal effort called Operation Welcome. This program built shelters in the Amazon, issued documents, and paid for transportation so Venezuelans could move to cities where jobs were available. Seeley says Brazil understood something essential early on.
You know, if you actually let people get a job legally and you let kids get into school legally, you don't need to spend a lot more public resources trying to help them adjust to the new society. They'll take care of themselves. You know, and I think that kind of pragmatism is getting lost in some of the ideological debates around immigration.
The fact was, research showed these people boost local economies. People fill job vacancies, open businesses, and pay taxes. But across Latin America, the openness of those early years is beginning to fade. Governments are pulling back, squeezed by tight budgets and strained public resources.
We're talking about countries that have chronic needs of their own, right? The education systems, healthcare systems. So when people arrive from other countries, it really puts a strain on those services, right?
In countries like Chile, Ecuador, and Peru, slowing economies and rising crime have also hardened public attitudes, even when data shows immigrants commit fewer crimes than locals.
Over time, they become less generous because the issue becomes much more politicized.
Even in Colombia, once the region's most generous host, the registry for the 10-year permit is now closed. One factor contributing to that, says Ana Karina Garcia, is the loss of U.S. funding for migrant programs.
La eliminación del TPS, entre otros, ha llevado a que los venezolanos que están retornando del norte...
Venezuelans returning from the U.S., some who lost temporary protected status or asylum cases, are now arriving in Colombia with no way to legalize their stay. Before, they would have qualified for the protection permit, but now they risk falling into informal jobs or even being recruited by criminal groups. For years, Latin America showed that welcoming displaced people wasn't just compassionate. It was practical. Now the question is whether those early experiments can survive and if those countries can keep their doors open. For the world, I'm Tivisa Isea, Mexico City.
In Italy today, Parliament passed a law making femicide punishable with life in prison. According to the United Nations, one woman or girl is killed every 10 minutes by a partner or family member. The new Italian law also bolsters prosecution of other crimes that disproportionately impact women. Cecilia Sotilota teaches politics at the University for Foreigners at Perugia. She says the new bill introduces a definition of femicide in Italy.
This is what is contained in this new bill. So a femicide is different, say, from a homicide, in that the victim is a woman and the perpetrator can be anyone, but the victim is a woman and she's being victimized for the mere fact of being a woman and what comes with it.
Now, I understand that crime overall in Italy is decreasing, but the number of murders is increasing, especially homicides by partners or ex-partners. They are up 15%. Is it clear why?
Well, I think that the problem in Italy is a very deep-rooted patriarchal, we must say, culture, which finds this expression, tragic expression, in femicide. Now, the problem is that in the past few years, I mean, Italy is going through a number of issues. It's a country which economically is stagnating. There's no sex education in schools. Okay, so we may say there certainly are socioeconomic causes, but also sociological ones. Violence against women is accepted. Okay, and it's accepted also in the subtle forms.
So how significant do you see this new legislation as? I mean, do you think it is likely to bring about any change?
It is important for two reasons. First of all, it's important for symbolic reasons because it means that finally the political establishment recognized that femicide is indeed an issue on the one hand. On the second hand, it is also important because it shows that the government and opposition can indeed from time to time and at least for very important issues work together. Okay, these are the two positive things. Now, on the other hand, I think that this bill, unfortunately, only addresses the repression of the crime. So it's really about punishment, but really not about prevention.
What does the data show about what works to actually prevent femicide and gender-based violence?
Well, for instance, on the 25th of November, two bills were to be voted. So one is the one we're talking about, and the other one is actually about consent, and it's a bill trying to address sexual violence in general. Well, that second bill was torpedoed basically by Salvini's League, which is a coalition partner of Giorgia Meloni.
The bill would have required consent for sexual activity. Otherwise, it would be considered rape legally.
Exactly. So, and he defines consent as free and current. Okay. So it would be a revolution in a sense in the Italian legal order because it would finally acknowledge this issue and it would also help avoid re-traumatization, secondary re-victimization of victims of sexual violence. But when the moment came for the bill to pass through the Senate, basically the North League blocked it, which again gives you a sense of the fact that, and many voters, I would say, were on board with that because they thought that this kind of bill would give too much power to women. That's what also Salvini said. It's too much power. It exposes men to vendettas and revenge by women who, in his reading, would be accusing men unjustly.
I'm wondering, though, is there research or evidence or data on what does actually move the needle when it comes to perpetrating gender-based violence? Is this a matter of cultural change?
Yes, I would say that what really is needed are long-term plan, which entails emotional and sex education, starting from a very early age for kids, both girls and boys. This is a country where, for instance, minors, and it's not just Italy, but minors are exposed from a very young age to, for instance, porn. So there's a lot of violent digital content young people are exposed to. And on the other hand, they do not receive guidance that may counterbalance this kind of violent content that may shape the way in which they think of relationships, including to women.
Last time we spoke in August, there was a major scandal in Italy involving deepfake videos of Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni that appeared on a porn website. There were also calls for tougher laws against revenge porn at the time. Did anything happen there? Where does that stand?
Yeah, actually, you know, this bill, the one on femicide, also contains new regulation that makes punishment for crimes such as revenge porn, for instance, harsher. So in a sense, the situation sparked a debate that is, at least on the repression side, on the punishment side, changing things a little bit.
Is there any movement on this idea of education in schools, the thing that you say would actually potentially move the needle?
This is a very sensitive issue because it is one of the subjects of Meloni's coalition culture wars. So there's a lot of resistance to the idea that young people may be exposed to ideas that may entail, for instance, a discussion of what gender is, that gender is fluid, you know, that all these things are seen by the government, the current governing coalition, as indoctrination, left-wing indoctrination, hence this resistance to introducing this kind of intervention in schools.
Mm. So it's interesting to me that there's this law, you know, at the very top level, everybody can get behind the idea of harsh punishments for femicide. But some of the things that might actually really change the situation before women are harmed, conversations around that are not really happening.
Exactly. But if you think about it, that's what right-wing, in general, politicians like. I mean, they are pretty much in favor, and that's part of the ideological sort of approach to repression, per se, to harsher punishment and stricter laws for certain crimes, at least. While on the other hand, when we start to enter the slippery slope of issues that they consider controversial, things evidently change.
Cecilia Sotilota is an assistant professor at the University for Foreigners of Perugia. She spoke with us from Rome. Across the country, many of the workers who are personal care aides for people with disabilities are immigrants. This can lead to friendships that cross cultures, as reporter Megan Smith from GBH saw when she visited a Thanksgiving celebration at a residential care home near Boston.
Junior Paris is from Haiti. He's a residential manager and has worked at the Guild for Human Services for 20 years.
Honestly, just to make a difference in everyone's life.
He's bonded with Jacob Flax. Flax lives in a group home in Dedham. Tonight they enjoyed puff puffs, deep-fried dough balls popular in West Africa.
Did you try the puff puff?
They're delicious. They're sweet.
This is the annual Thanksgiving potluck hosted by the Guild. It's a nonprofit organization that supports adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities.
It's not just a traditional Thanksgiving, but it comes with food from all over the world.
Mustafa Abdullahi is the associate director of the Guild's residential services. He's from Ghana. Much of the food tonight is cooked by the Guild's 70 staff members. They joined about 70 adult residents who live in the Guild's group homes around the Boston area.
So you're looking at food from East Africa, you're looking at food from West Africa, food from South America. We have staff from about 45 countries. That's how much diversity that gets celebrated.
Abdullahi has found joy and friendship working at the Guild. And something else.
I call it home. I call it our little village, a small family.
And the Guild isn't unique. But with the Trump administration increasing deportations and tightening restrictions on refugee programs, a lot of families who have kids with disabilities have told GBH News over the last few months that they're worried. Worried that the workers who help their children live dignified lives may get caught up in deportations or not come to work out of fear. Here's Abdullahi again.
Immigration is a big thing for our staff and then their families, the uncertainties around what the scope of what administration, how they handling all of these things. It's become more difficult.
But inside the celebration tonight, it's all joy. Gina Jermel is serving residents and staff.
This is puff puff, chapati, sweet plantain, and that's the fried turkey wings that I was telling you about, jollof rice, and this is some shredded turkey.
Jermel is a residential manager, and she's worked with some of these residents for 11 years. The staff and residents here share a special bond. At the end of the celebration, resident Jacob Flax grabbed the microphone for some karaoke as staff members joined residents on the dance floor. They danced and sang together. Whatever is happening in the world, they're grateful to be here together.
Megan Smith there with GBH here in Boston. Birdwatchers in New Hampshire got a rare treat this past weekend. A European cuckoo was spotted in a cemetery in the coastal city of Portsmouth. The birds are native to parts of Europe, as the name suggests, and also Asia. They're almost never seen here in the Western Hemisphere. Nevertheless, you probably recognize the sound they make. This is a recording from the website eBird, not of the cuckoo spotted in New Hampshire. Still, sounds familiar, right? Probably because of the cuckoo clock. It's unclear how this cuckoo bird wound up so far from its usual habitat, but that's what makes these sightings such a thrill for bird watchers here in the States. According to local news in New Hampshire, another European cuckoo was spotted on Long Island last month, sending birders and scientists scrambling to catch a glimpse. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The annual migration of monarch butterflies from Canada to Mexico is a marvel of nature. It is a journey that scientists and citizen scientists have been tracking since the 1950s, when people began tagging the butterflies with stickers the size of postage stamps. Low-tech sticker tagging has been pretty much the standard ever since. Now, a new technology could revolutionize the effort to track monarch butterflies as they migrate across North America. I'm talking about a lightweight, solar-powered radio tag tiny enough to attach to a monarch butterfly. Orly Chip Taylor in Lawrence, Kansas, is the founder of Monarch Watch, and he is considered the leading expert on the monarch migration. Taylor described the new butterfly tracking project to my co-host, Marco Werman.
Oh, this is fantastic. I mean, this is you couldn't wish for anything better if you're a monarch biologist, because we have so many unanswered questions about how this population moves in the fall, how they get to Mexico. And what we're seeing in the data is, yes, a lot of our ideas were confirmed, but there's a lot of new stuff coming along, things that you have wanted to learn for a long time.
So how does it work, actually?
Well, the solar power puts out a signal every 3 seconds when it's in sunlight. And that ping can be detected within maybe 100 to 150 meters. And the real remarkable thing here is that these signals can be detected by Bluetooth-operated devices. They could be your cell phone, or it could be some other sort of Bluetooth-operated devices. And there are millions and millions and millions of detectors out there.
So I downloaded the app from Project Monarch, and I'm looking at the map, and there are butterfly sightings all over the country. I mean, it's almost like the plains, except these are butterflies. So these are being spotted via those Bluetooth receivers. Is that right?
That's correct. And it's fantastic now that when you look at the individual tracks of these butterflies, one of the things that you see is that they're blown around quite a bit. They're pushed off course here and there. And what that means is if they're going to be able to succeed in getting to Mexico, which is the ultimate direction that they're going, that they have to course correct. Now, we knew they were course correcting. I mean, it was obvious that they had to be able to do this, but the magnitude of the course corrections that we're seeing in the data is absolutely fantastic. These butterflies are picking up on information that somehow gets them back on course, and we don't quite understand how that is accomplished.
What kind of effort does it actually take to affix the tracker to the butterfly?
Yeah, that's the thing. It takes quite a bit of skill to do this, because you have to manage to do this without damaging the butterfly. And you can do it. It's probably easier to do it if you chill the butterfly down a little bit and then open its wings and hold the wings open so that the thorax is exposed, and then you apply the tag. And guess what? You apply the tag with eyelash glue. Who knew?
Wow. Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
Chip, let's step back for a moment and talk about the monarch migration itself. Where do the butterflies start their journey and where do they end up?
Well, most of the butterflies that reach the overwintering sites originate from major pathways, a pathway out of the Midwest, pathway coming out of Ontario that cuts across the country. a pathway down the Atlantic coast, a pathway along the Gulf Coast. So the butterflies are using ways to get to the border with Texas and Mexico. And then they have pretty much a straight shot down to the overwintering sites once they get into Mexico, a little zigzag as they go. Then the butterflies originate the migration at about the end of the first week of August, and then they slowly move down the country. Eventually, by the 1st of November, most of them have crossed over into Mexico. And then we have about the end of February, we should start to see some of these butterflies moving north again.
So you've described the path of the monarchs south, but I mean, what does it look like? Describe this migration.
Well, it depends upon where you are. There are times when a front will come through where you can literally see masses and masses of butterflies moving through an area. But they're hard to predict, and we're not seeing the clusters that we used to see. The population is much lower now because we've lost a lot of habitat.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about the dropping population of monarch butterflies. What is causing that?
Well, we've lost a lot of habitat because of changes in agriculture and, of course, development. Then we've lost a lot of acreage, really starting in the late 90s due to the adoption of Roundup Ready corn and soybeans. That eliminated milkweeds that were growing in row crops. That had a big effect because the populations that were coming out of those agricultural fields were really quite large. And we can see that with our tagging data, that our tagging went down everywhere where those crops were adopted. So, yeah, it's been an environmental change that's had a big impact. And now we're dealing with climate change.
Why is it important to track monarchs, Chip, and how can this new technology help with all the pressures on the butterflies?
Yeah, everything helps to really understand how this migration works. You know, we can see the writing on the wall. We're going to lose this migration unless we actually deal with some fundamental issues. We have to replace a lot of habitat. And the tagging systems show us where the origins are. They show us where the success is. That's the one issue. The other issue is that we really have to understand what climate change is doing to these populations. And so the tagging systems tell us a lot about the dynamics of the population that we can't get just by observation.
In other words, the impact of climate change on the butterfly population. That can tell you about climate change itself.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the March temperatures send the butterflies too far north too soon. If you get too far north too soon, very often, the eggs that are scattered get killed by late spring frosts. In order to have a population succeed and grow, the physical conditions really have to be ideal, and they're not ideal as they were in the past.
Mm. For these solar radio trackers for the monarch population, what is your hope, Chip, here ultimately?
Well, there are lots of questions that we haven't been able to answer. For example, when it's getting hotter in the southern part of the U.S., how many of those butterflies actually never make it to Mexico? So, you know, all of this feeds back into kind of understanding how the population works. Knowledge is understanding, and understanding can be turned into action.
Chip Taylor is a professor emeritus at the University of Kansas and the founder of Monarch Watch. He spoke this week with The World's Marco Werman. World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and find our original reporting on YouTube. Be sure to subscribe to our channel there. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for listening.
The World is supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.
from PRX.